This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Eleanor Hall. This Monday, the country braces for catastrophe with unprecedented fire conditions. And if you thought the situation couldn't get any more dangerous, a warning that they could be just the start of things to come.
All the projections are that the situations that we're seeing at the moment will only get worse in coming years unless emissions are reduced and unless temperature increases can be stabilised in some way.
Let's begin this lunchtime in the worst affected state, New South Wales. The Premier this morning declared a state of emergency ahead of tomorrow's warnings of extreme conditions, including for the first time a catastrophic warning for the Greater Sydney region. And communities in the state's north are reeling from a horrific and fatal few days. Thomas Ariti begins our coverage.
This could be as bad as it gets. The Sydney region, including the Blue Mountains and the Central Coast, is preparing for tomorrow's catastrophic conditions. And it comes as the state is already grappling with a bushfire crisis. The New South Wales Premier, Gladys Berejiklian, has declared a week-long state of emergency beginning today.
I want to assure the people of New South Wales that this is a precautionary stance. This is to make sure that we leave no stone unturned to keep our community safe tomorrow.
A precaution it may be, but we don't see a declaration like this every time the region experiences a bushfire. In fact, it was last made in October 2013.
We want to ensure that the lines of authority are clear tomorrow. We also want to ensure that we're doing everything we can to keep life and property safe.
The declaration allows powers to be transferred from the New South Wales government to the Commissioner of the state's Rural Fire Service. That gives the RFS the ability to control and coordinate government resources, close roads, order the shutdown of essential utilities, and enter or take possession of property. David Elliott is the state's Minister for Police and Emergency Services.
This is a tool that governments very, very rarely use, but it is a tool that is necessary. The people of New South Wales have the right to know that we as a government will be providing every financial and operational level of support to the Rural Fire Service to get us through what potentially could be the most dangerous bushfire week this nation has ever seen.
The catastrophic fire danger warning was first introduced 10 years ago, but this is the first time it's been declared for the Sydney region. So, why now? Well, for one, temperatures are set to soar into the mid to high 30s. Combine that with high winds and next to no humidity, and the risks are high. RFS Commissioner Shane Fitzsimmons says there's one key piece of advice.
Under catastrophic conditions, the safest thing you can do is not be in an at-risk area. Catastrophic conditions, the focus is principally and foremost on life safety. Life is at risk when it comes to catastrophic conditions, and as we've said for decades now, we cannot guarantee a fire truck at every home. We cannot guarantee an aircraft will be overhead every time a fire is impacting on your property.
And even outside the Greater Sydney area, he says communities should be on alert.
Not only have we got the catastrophic fire danger ratings being identified in the forecast for the Greater Sydney environment and the Greater Hunter region, we've got to keep in mind that right across a much broader geographic area, we will continue to have severe and widespread extreme fire danger ratings extending from the northern border of our state up around the New England, the Northern Tablelands, the Northern Rivers area, right down through the mid-coast, out through the central west areas of New South Wales, down across the Greater Sydney environment and through to the Illawarra and Shoalhaven.
It comes after a devastating few days for communities in northern New South Wales. Three people have died, at least 150 homes have been lost, including one belonging to Glen Innes resident David Peters.
The ceiling started burning above me in the corner, and I thought, oh, gee, I better put that out, and I did. And then I turned around and the other corner was burning as well in the ceiling. So I put that one out. I got that one out. And then I looked back to the previous corner and it was a light again. So I decided then, I'm not going to be able to cope with this at all.
Further north in Bora Ridge, it's been a tough weekend for Doug Wood.
We went down to save. I live next door to my parents. We saved Mum and Dad's house and the people across the road's house, but we couldn't save ours.
And the crisis isn't confined to New South Wales. There are now about 50 fires burning across Queensland, with firefighters working to contain blazes in rural bushland areas from the far north of the state south to the New South Wales border. And conditions are also expected to deteriorate there tomorrow, with fires at Cobberable, west of Yeppoon, and Corroyba on the Sunshine Coast, as well as blazes in the western scenic rim of most concern. And with high temperatures today, authorities in other states, including Western Australia and South Australia, are also on alert.
Thomas Ariti reporting. Well, the region around Taree on the New South Wales mid-north coast is one of the areas worst affected by the fires. Our reporter Julia Holman is at the Taree Regional Airport, which is the temporary headquarters for the region's aerial firefighting operations. She joins us now. Julia, you're at the airport watching these firefighting aircraft being launched. What are the conditions like?
Eleanor, the conditions are quite difficult here at the moment. It's incredibly smoky here, even though we're quite a distance from any active fire. There's smoke just hanging in the air, and that's stopping aircraft from getting up and fighting fires to the level that they would have liked. There's unprecedented levels of resources, though, being put in here and around the state to try to put out a number of blazes that are threatening many areas in New South Wales.
What warnings are now in place for those fires?
Well, there are a number of fires around this area, and the real concern, Eleanor, is that there just are, even though there are unprecedented resources being put in, that it's not going to be enough to extinguish them before the catastrophic conditions that are forecast for tomorrow. One of the challenges that people I was speaking to here at the airport who are sending choppers up is that access to water is a real challenge, that there just isn't the water there to fight the fires like they would ideally like. Authorities are telling people at this stage that they really should be packing up their car, doing the best that they can to look after their properties. But if they don't need to be in a bush area, that they should be getting out today.
You've spent the night in Taree talking to those people who have already fled. Some of them have lost their homes. How are they faring?
Well, look, Eleanor, people are remarkably stoic, which is remarkable considering the situation that they're facing and the uncertainty that other people are facing when they don't know if they will be able to go home. The evacuation centres, I mean, they're very well resourced. There's a lot of care and a lot of love being given to people who are stuck there. They're stocked up with food, with pet food for the animals, for board games for the kids, mattresses. But really, there's nobody wants to be at those evacuation centres, but the best care is being provided to those people who really need it. There's also chaplains and counsellors who I saw speaking with people who are there, trying to give them the support that they need. A lot of people are also dropping in to get things that they might need, so they might need towels or they might need food or, as I said, pet food for their animals. One person who I spoke to who was dropping into the evacuation centre was Jacqueline and her husband Paul Herring. They've been staying in emergency accommodation in Taree for the past 3 days.
We're all pretty low-key, but we're in awe of what's been done by the resources here. You know, the RFS have saved our home, but the resources that all come together in times like this is just extraordinary. This is the Australian way. You know, people all come together in the spirit of harmony and goodwill. And so we're just extremely grateful. But we haven't lost our house, but there are others that have, and lives as well. So we spare a thought for them.
How close was it to losing your house? You said the RFS saved it?
Well, they came in, it jumped the fire trail and into our dam, and the RFS came in trying to put it out. They were unable to do that, so the water bomber came in and put it out. This is what I'm told by my neighbour. We haven't been able to get home, but this is what I'm told, that it was saved by the water bomber and the aircraft. So we're very, very lucky.
They're amazing tools, aren't they? And hopefully there's enough of them.
Yes, absolutely. And we're very thankful for all the services because they've done such a brilliant job. I mean, people are very, very generous, aren't they?
Undoubtedly. It's just heartening to see. I mean, heartbreaking to see what's happened to some people, but heartening to see how everybody comes together at a time like this.
How are you feeling about the weather conditions going forward? Because this isn't the end of it. They're saying Tuesday, you know, will be catastrophic.
Yeah, so, gosh, you don't really know, can you? You can't predict what's going to happen. Hopefully all goes well, but who knows, really, you know? At this point, we're fine, but at any fires can jump, they can flare up. I mean, Who can tell, honestly?
And what preparation have you done to make sure that your house is as safe as it can be?
Well, we were fortunate, I think, in that we have a fire trail and I keep that fairly clear, and on acres as well, and I keep that fairly clear. So we're always sort of kind of prepared, but these things are unpredictable. The magnitude of the fires that came through were just horrific. I mean, they're just like a freight train, and they moved at such a pace and with such intensity that nobody can control it, not even the firefighters. So you just never know. We're just in the lap of the gods, I suppose, really, aren't we?
Showing extraordinary resilience there, Paul and Jacqueline Herring, speaking to our reporter Julia Holman in Taree, one of the worst affected areas on the New South Wales mid-north coast. This is The World Today. You can find us on the ABC Listen app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Well, the extreme nature of these fires has again fuelled debate about whether climate change has contributed to the crisis. While fire crews are battling the flames, politicians are arguing about whether it's even suitable to be discussing climate change now with the disaster still unfolding. And there are also concerns about whether all Australians will in future be able to insure their homes as the risk of extreme fires increases. David Sparks has our report.
Political leaders, both in the big cities and in regional councils affected by these fires, have called on Australians to recognise the role of climate change in this disaster. But some have taken exception to this. The Deputy Prime Minister, Michael McCormack, was asked this morning for his reaction to those making the connection between the fires and climate change.
We've had fires in Australia since time began. And what people need now is a little bit of sympathy, understanding and real assistance. They need help. They need shelter. They don't need the ravings of some pure, enlightened and woke capital city greenies at this time when they're trying to save their homes, when in fact they're going out in many cases and saving other people's homes and leaving their own homes at risk. What they don't need is Adam Bant and Richard Di Natale trying to get a political point score on this. I mean, it is disgraceful, it is disgusting, and I'll call it out every time.
But it's not just the Greens making the connection. Those in the communities actually affected by the fires are also drawing the link. Carol Sparks is the Mayor of Glen Innes, a community in northern New South Wales which has lost lives and homes. Over the weekend, she pointed to climate change as a contributing factor. After the Deputy Prime Minister spoke this morning, Carol Sparks was asked what she thought of his comments.
Well, I probably couldn't respond how I really feel on television, but I think that Michael McCormack needs to read the science, and that is what I'm going by, is the science. Of course, it's not relevant at the moment when people's houses are burning and you've lost lives and you've lost friends and you've lost family. You don't think, oh, this is climate change. You think, what am I going to do next and how am I going to save myself? But the overall thing is we are so dry in this country, and to deny climate change is, to me, a very ill-informed and uneducated way of looking at things.
But one group of dispassionate observers clearly thinks climate change is a factor that needs to be taken into account. That's actuaries, the people who crunch the numbers for banks, insurance companies and most other financial institutions. Raed Musselin from Finity Consulting is the lead author of the Australian Actuaries Climate Index.
Obviously, as the risk changes, the insurance system will adapt by, adjusting pricing and coverages and underwriting activities to reflect risk. So to the degree that the risk is changing, then the insurance system will change with it.
I've heard talk of homes in certain areas becoming uninsurable in the future because of the bushfire risk. Is that a realistic possibility that people in fire-prone areas might end up with uninsurable homes?
Well, there's been a lot of talk about that, and I can't really comment specifically on people having uninsurable or higher costs. But there's no question that in some parts of Australia, as the climate changes, there will be some upward pressure placed on prices in areas of higher risk.
He says climate change will force policy changes to rethink their approach.
We really need to future-proof our building codes. And right now, we probably are not doing enough to look far into the future and realize that if a house is built and intended to be there for 50 or 100 years, we need to consider the climate conditions and the risks that property are going to face over the next 50 or 100 years. And I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done to make sure that what we're building is sustainable and will be affordable to insure.
And he has a straightforward message for Australia's political leaders.
Well, I'm no politician, and I wouldn't ever pretend to be able to advise a politician. But I think what I would say that at least in the scientific community, there's very little debate about the fact that the climate is changing, that risks are increasing, and that we need to plan for that. And I think it's really important for Australia that we plan for the future, that we try to do what we can reasonably to future-proof our building codes and build safer communities.
That's actuary Raed Musselin from Finity Consulting. That report by David Sparks. Well, Ken Thompson was Deputy Commissioner of Fire and Rescue in New South Wales until 2011. He's the co-founder of the group Emergency Leaders for Climate Action, which includes 23 former senior firefighters from across the nation who have more than 600 years of experience between them. They've been requesting a meeting with the Prime Minister to discuss how to better prepare for the worsening extreme weather that they say is being spurred by climate change. Not only has the Prime Minister so far refused to meet them, but today, as we've been hearing, the Deputy Prime Minister has called the integrity of those in the group into question. Ken Thompson says he's frustrated and disappointed by the way he and his fellow senior firefighters have been rebuffed by the federal government.
You know, most of us have well in excess of 30 years' experience. And we've seen a lot of changes in fire behaviour over that time. We've been noticing very significant changes in fire behaviour over the last, particularly 10 to 15 years. And I guess we became frustrated because there's been a lot of research out there for 30 years now that points to climate change being a big contributing factor. And we thought, really, this is an issue that we need to take to the top. We need to take it to the Prime Minister. And we need to talk about the issues that we feel need to be addressed, particularly at the national level.
So are you surprised that you haven't had a more positive response from the Prime Minister?
We're surprised. We're disappointed. We're frustrated. You know, this is a really big issue. And the science has been projecting exactly the types of conditions that we're seeing at the moment for a long, long time. And we felt that it was important for the Prime Minister to hear from us.
What specifically would you have asked Mr. Morrison to do had you had the opportunity to meet him?
Well, I think the important thing for us was to talk to him and give him our perspective, you know, based on the science and based on our own observations. Our main concern is with bushfire that our fire seasons are becoming much, much longer than they historically, you know, as they would run for about 6 months of the year. Now they're running for about 8 to 9 months of the year. And that's putting enormous pressure on firefighters and enormous pressure on the community. One of the big problems we have is that during the large bushfire campaigns, large aircraft are needed to be able to combat those fires. And those aircraft come down during our fire season at the end of the Northern Hemisphere fire season. Problem is that their fire seasons are becoming a lot longer as well. So we're being left vulnerable by not having those types of aircraft available to us in Australia at a time when we most need them. Those aircraft are incredibly expensive to buy and to operate, and they're beyond the capacity of the states and the territories to do that. So we wanted to talk to the Prime Minister about extending an existing program rather than waiting for something to become available from the Northern Hemisphere.
Emergency services leaders are generally highly respected as apolitical, but the Deputy Prime Minister this morning dismissed the letters from your group as possibly a, quote, front for something else. Are you some sort of political front, this Emergency Leaders for Climate Action group?
We're simply a group of 23 former fire and emergency services commissioners and deputy commissioners who have a very long-standing and very serious concern about human-induced climate change and its impact on the Australian environment and Australian people.
So what was your reaction when you heard the Deputy Prime Minister make those comments this morning?
Look, I don't really want to get into the whole finger-pointing and name-calling issue. As I said, we're trying to come to the table to bring issues that we see as being of national concern to the Australian government. And climate change is the issue. The science is very, very clear. There's no point not mentioning it. You kind of have to talk about it.
Well, certainly the Prime Minister Minister, the Deputy Prime Minister, the New South Wales Premier have stressed they're not interested in talking about climate change right now. Do you have some sympathy that now is not the time to talk about it when they're visiting those people most seriously affected by the fires?
Yeah, our concern as firefighters, a big part of our training and a part of our culture is about prevention. Now, when prevention fails, you know, you get the situation that you've got now. And you know, we certainly empathise enormously. You know, is it a time to talk about it? I think we need to talk about it pretty soon, if not today. We perhaps should have been talking about it, you know, 4 or 5 months ago when we first started writing these letters.
How frustrating is it for you watching the horrific scenes across New South Wales and the rest of the country, knowing that you could possibly have been able to put in place some form of enhanced preparation if you'd had the opportunity to meet with the Prime Minister?
Look, I mean, I can't hide my frustration. Would it have made a difference if we'd had meetings back then? It may have. The aircraft situation may have been eased in some way. You know, I often hear people in the media saying, you know, we were caught by surprise, or the community has been caught by surprise. Well, really, there shouldn't have been any surprise. It is frustrating that climate change, as one minister described it to me many years ago, is the poison chalice of politics. I mean, it's something that we really need to be talking about. It's happening.
What do you fear that we will be facing next year and in future years if we don't actually come to grips with this?
People have been using the term that, you know, this is the new normal. And, you know, I was too for a while, but then I thought, no, this isn't the new normal. The old normal has gone, but this is more like a stepping stone towards even greater catastrophes. It's not going to stay like this. All the projections are that the situations that we're seeing at the moment will only get worse.
That's former Deputy Commissioner of Fire and Rescue in New South Wales, Ken Thompson. He's the co-founder of the group Emergency Leaders for Climate Action. Moving on from the fires now, Australians gamble an estimated $400 million a year on illegal offshore betting websites. Now the federal government is moving to block access to the sites. Its motive? To claw back $100 million in unpaid taxes. Rhett Burney has our story.
Australians love a bet, and according to the government, they quite often come out the loser, even when they've won on illegal offshore gambling sites.
There's quite a regular stream of complaints from Australians who have placed bets on these sites, and when they've won, they find it very difficult to collect their money. So these sites will take real money, but they won't pay out.
That's Cyber Safety Minister Paul Fletcher. He says the game is up for the sites.
There are quite a number that are in operation. Over 1,000, in fact, are estimated to be in operation.
From today, the Australian Communication and Media Authority, or ACMA, will issue internet service providers with legal notices telling them to block access to illegal offshore gambling sites identified by the government.
It will be moving quickly to block at least one website in the short term. And it will be actively exercising its powers in response to complaints.
It's also about protecting tax revenue. About $100 million in tax is estimated to be lost to the illegal sites annually. It's taken years for the government's website blocking scheme to come into play. It was announced in response to the 2015 O'Farrell Review into Illegal Offshore Wagering. And cybersecurity and safety expert Troy Hunt says while blocking access to the websites will be easy for the government to do, stopping Australians from logging onto them won't.
It's also something that's easy to circumvent as an individual just by using a VPN.
So can you explain to me what a VPN is?
So a VPN is a virtual private network. It creates an encrypted connection between your machine, whether that be your PC or your phone or whatever device it is you're using, and a VPN provider. And there's a lot of VPN providers out there that cost a few bucks a month, and they have what we'd refer to as exit nodes in different countries. So, for example, if you wanted to use an online gambling service, let's say it's in the Philippines, and you can find a VPN provider with an exit node in the Philippines, you can create an encrypted connection between your device and a point in the Philippines.
Troy Hunt says it effectively tricks the system and bypasses any blocks put in place in Australia.
Now, anything sitting in the middle, whether that be the government or your ISP or even the hotel Wi-Fi, can't see where you're going.
Despite that, Troy Hunt says not all Australians will be rushing to get a VPN, especially given the number of complaints lodged against offshore sites not paying up.
Look, it won't stamp it out in any absolute sense. It will reduce it.
Troy Hunt is a cybersecurity and safety expert. Rhett Burney with that story. And that's all from the World Today team for this Monday. Linda Mottram and the PM team will be along this evening with all the latest on the fires. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Eleanor Hall, wishing you a safe afternoon.
Hi, I'm Chris Dengate.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. Everyone wants to think they're living in a meritocracy. So why has the gap between the rich and the poor in Australia been growing for decades?
About half of Australia thinks that people experiencing poverty could get ahead if they just worked harder. So how true is that? Find The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.